time to come see me. I will say, I don't think the camera needs to hear this either, but I have a lot of stuff that I love, that I like to talk about. I will guarantee go over time. So if you let me go to my own devices, so I will stop 55 minutes into this, no matter where I'm at. So so if I go along, just raise a hand and say, you know, it's time for you to stop, and I will. Are we a go? All right, excellent. So I'm Chad Jenkins, as Mayor Wolf said, and I'll talk about a broader notion of sort of human-robot teaming and how learning can play a role in that. So I'll start. Here's an outline of topics that I'm gonna cover, and you know, guaranteed, I'm probably not gonna get to the bottom. But I'll make my best attempt. But first, let me start about what I think is the point of robotics. So a senior AI person and I just recently had dinner together, and he asked me, why do I get out of bed in the morning? You know, what makes me go? And I believe that the thing that robotics needs to have is we need to enable robots to be collaborators for human endeavors. That is, how do we actually make robots useful for people so that they don't even think about a robot? They don't, you know, people don't think about, I have a computer, I have a word processor. They want, you know, they just do what they're doing what they do towards a task. And the computer is just a useful tool for making that happen, or the best tool for making that happen. And this leads to notions of what are the critical applications of robots? What are the tools that let us explore these notions? And so one thing that I think about is sort of the flash of robotics, right? So lots of people use Macromedia Flash to make all sorts of animations, but they don't think about the lower level computation or anything that goes into that. So what kind of tools can we provide that are sort of like similar authoring tools such as Flash? And I believe this is facilitated by the plethora of robots that are coming up into the market. In particular, I don't necessarily build robots. I want to program robots. I want to be able to take something off the shelf and be able to instantiate interesting control policies on top of them. And with the diverse collection of cheaper, more capable robots, I think this is really going to enable a revolution in robotics. The question that has, so when I used to go to parties, I say, you know, they ask me people what I do, and I say I'm a computer scientist, and they would ask me, so how do I set up print server on Windows 95? And so nowadays I say I'm a roboticist. And so now that question has been replaced with, where is my robot? For which I don't have a really good answer. And I think that is the question that we need to be focusing on. When you look at how to answer where is my robot, it's helpful to think about other evolutions in computing, such as personal computing, which started with, you know, ENIAC and moved to Apple IIe's, and now you have the laptop is just a ubiquitous thing on campus. And now it's moving to you know, small personal laptops like the XO that it's cheap. It's cheap and anybody could use, you know, and it's just really gonna be out there. And there are similar revolutions in the internet, going from ARPANET to now YouTube and Gmail and graphics, which went from Sketchpad, and now you have photorealistic images, and you know, Madden just looks like, I mean, if you watch video games, you know, it looks like you're actually watching a football game on TV. So if you look at robotics research, we have Shaky, and now you can make a claim that Roomba and other things are starting to get out there, but how do we move from these people that are indifferent to the actual platform? What do we provide for them that will allow them to use robots as a tool? And I'll pick I'm gonna pick on RoboCup for a second, because they're so successful, and they do a really good job of progressing the state of the art. But if you look at who plays RoboCup, who is involved in RoboCup, you notice that, you know, there are a few people who are the invested, who are the programmers and builders, and you know, who have the technical expertise to get involved. But everybody else are sort of limited to being spectators. And they are, you know, they're very interested spectators, but we want to put them into the process. That's where our untapped potential is. How do we get these people involved? And I'll make a case that learning is one way to do it. You know, visual programming could be others, but learning is sort of the approach that I think that has a lot of people. So thinking about this revolution in personal robotics, we have to think about a couple of factors. I think one is robot programming. So how do you take the decision-making policy that's in a user's head and instantiate that onto the robot? roughly speaking, that you know, whenever the human is, whenever the robot's in a given situation, the robot should make the same decision that the human should make. And this question of content creation, or this question of how do you program robots, is related to content creation. So, you know, so if you want to make animations, you have Flash or Maya. You want to make a web page, there's Dreamweaver. You know, there's any number of authoring tools for creating digital content. But when you move from the digital world to the physical world, we have uncertainty, which makes our problem more difficult and I think more interesting, and more, and has greater potential for the next steps. The approaches that, I mean, I roughly classify approaches to robot programming as sort of the standard explicit programming approach, and that works well for my students like Brendan, who worked on RoboCop, this type of stuff with me. So he has the ability to write code to make things go. Another approach is to do teleoperation. So this was one inertial-based motion capture suit that we used to drive the Robonaut. And teleoperation is good, but it makes the user, the human user, keep their situational awareness, their focus on the robot, and you're not able to delegate things to the robot to have them do it on their own. And the approach that I will advocate for is learning. And we'll provide game-based interfaces to collect lots and lots and lots of data that we could potentially learn from and build policies. Another thing was that when I did my dissertation, what I was able to produce at the end was free space motion, but nothing that interacted with the world or other objects. And you know, after some soul searching, I said, maybe, you know, the thing that I'm missing is manipulation. I need to be able to, the robotics is more interesting. Yeah, manipulation. You know, the thing that makes robotics really more compelling, I shouldn't say more compelling, but very interesting, is the ability to move atoms instead of flipping things, right? We don't have state that's easily controlled. We are gonna do things in the real world where people actually want things done. You know, I can make a physical simulation to fold my laundry, but what I really want to end is something that will fold my laundry. And so there's a variety of different manipulators that are going on that we have, but I think that's just something that's incredibly important. Another issue is communication. So how do we have runtime interactions with robots? How do we actually tell the robot, you know, I want you to do this, or provide guidance, or demonstrate what you actually want the robot to do. So there's all sorts of gesture-based mechanisms, speech-based mechanisms. Multi-robot control is another set of communication. So, you know, towards the limit, you're going to have huge human-robot teams that have to be able to communicate with each other in order to get things done. Not to mention, you have to have some sort of sociability with these robots. You know, I grew up with an Apple IIe, and that was, while I loved it, it wasn't the most social thing. Which meant that me, as the sort of computer-oriented person, really liked using it, but everybody else didn't. But those are the people that we really want to get involved with. And another thing that I personally don't work in, but I think is a very synergistic area that's related to me, is the area of human factors, usability, the real experimental aspects. And so, you know, so when I collaborate with the NASA team, they have a teleoperator who uses, electromagnetic track gloves, and he has a head-mounted display. He has to use the pedals to make the Segway not go, and you know, that doesn't look extremely comfortable. I don't think you're going to get a lot of people to do that. So I think there has to be this loop between building robots and how we program them, and then deploying them, evaluating, and then rethinking how we build and program robots to then deploy and evaluate again, in this sort of continual loop. So with these sort of factors in mind, I will talk about how my research has progressed from from my doctoral work in imitation and learning motion primitives, and how that then influenced the new directions that I explored when I was at Brown, particularly for mobile human-robot teaming, lifelong learning from demonstration, particularly in the robot soccer domain, sparse control for towards, hopefully, neural prosthetics. How do we actually sort of sense that you're going to pick up, how you are successfully picking up objects when you're from a robot hand that maybe has a sparse set of force sensors? I'll talk about some recent work that we've done in trying to unify multi-robot coordination mechanisms using Markov random fields. And maybe I'll have time to allude about about using physical simulation within monocular human tracking. So my dissertation work was on imitation learning. So by imitation learning, you know that you have some human and they have some feedback control loop working where they have an embodiment and they perceive the world and make decisions and they have then they use motion control to make themselves go. And a robot, a humanoid robot, this simulated robot that was simulated using SDFast from the Jessica Hodgins line of simulated robots. It has a very similar loop. And what we want in imitation is essentially to take our observed human motion, or what we're observing of human behavior. So we had a very basic 2.5D kinematic tracking system. And then essentially you're trying to find a policy that matches your observations, right? And so this work was done well before I had video making capabilities, but to maybe illustrate this a little bit, we did do some work on sketch-based facial animation. So this is an undergraduate project that I advised. And this project was to take, you had like some parameterized model of facial animation, of facial poses. And what you do is you would select an area of the face, and then you select an area where you want that originally sort of selected area to move to. So you can select, I want this to move, and then a target area for that to go. And that's very similar to to this sort of notion of animate of, whoops. So this gets to a similar notion of imitation when we apply this to video. So we have somebody with tracked features in video, and we want to make those tracked features sort of look like, we want to make those features move on the face in a similar fashion to the features that we're observing. So while that's not robotics, it sort of gets to a similar notion of imitation, of taking what you're observing and encoding it in the robot's space of behaviors. So at the time, we thought about using optimization-based methods. So how do you take, some observation of human motion and then optimizing over some sort of, maybe joint angle space or, heaven forbid, torque space in order to make the movement observation, make the robot control match the movement observations. But optimizing in this space, we thought it was computationally prohibitive. So Maya, who's much more of the neuro-inspired person, said, well, why don't we use, motor primitives, because she's a big behavior-based person, and she said, instead of going this hard route, why don't you make it a little bit easier and learn a set of basic predictive motion primitives and say that the movement dynamics, that govern human motion is actually a linear combination of a set of predictive motor primitives, a set of nonlinear dynamical systems that produce motion. And so this actually is taken from neuroscience, sort of the mirror neuron hypothesis. And if you take mirror neurons with the concept of spinal fields, you could make a claim that human motion, both perception and motion control, is sort of governed by a set of basic motion building blocks. And so these are encoded into the central nervous system, and these are called spinal fields. And then you have certain areas in the brain that fire whenever you think about or perform or watch somebody perform a certain action. And that firing relates to these sort of linear coefficients. So this provides a linear basis for human motion. And please, anytime, if somebody has questions, I'd be happy to. And so this comes down to spinal fields as predictive models of human motion and mirror neurons as classification mechanisms for saying, I see this motion happening, maybe I also want to produce it. So prediction and classification. The question is that where do we get these predictive models from? Where do they come from? Well, they were originally found, but we were inspired by the work of Gister, who looked at frogs and rats and other mammals that said if you apply electricity to different parts of the nervous system, then you get convergent behavior that end effector moves to particular positions, and different locations on the nervous system will move the end effector to different locations. Obviously, I can't take a human and start applying electricity to various parts of their nervous system, but I can collect human motion capture data. All right, that video is not going to play. So what this was various human motion data of performing circles and semaphore language and punching and dancing, just a long string of unsegmented raw sort of motions. What we'd like to do is take from that data, we'd like to break it up and generalize. We'd like to cluster it. We want to segment, cluster, and then generalize each of those clusters into dynamical systems that express some sort of action, some sort of representative behavior that we found in this motion. And that video is not going to play either. But what this video would have showed you is what these primitives are. They're actually potential fields in joint angle space. So what would happen is you would start from some initial pose and then you would track. And so this is a two-dimensional view of a potential field in joint angle space. Use PCA to reduce it to two dimensions. But you would start in some initial pose, and then this potential field would be able to predict motion and lead you to this sort of region of attraction. And that would cause this motion to make the arm go like this. And then you'd start from another pose where the arm would be up here and then it would move in this direction. And then the third pose would be lower and would move in this direction. So we sort of span the space of all possible waves across the body using this potential field that we're going to learn from human motion. So then we'll have, and this will be combined with mirror neurons for classification. And so these fire whenever you execute or observe a particular action. and later I'll talk about how we use these for binocular human tracking from vision. I won't talk about how it's done in movement imitation so much, but we do have papers from humanoids, autonomous robots, and the International Journal of Humanoid Robotics. So how do we actually take a long stream of human motion? So these are joint angles in some high-dimensional space, reasonably high dimensions. Let's say I think it's about 70 degrees of freedom for each frame of motion. And this is a time series, so each frame is temporally dependent upon the other. But the first attempt that we did was we said, let's use principal component analysis, right? So does everybody have an idea what principal component analysis is? All right, great. So principal component analysis, which is, as Fernando told me again today, is equivalent to Euclidean multidimensional scaling. So we take this data, we applied PCA to it, where each principal component we consider that to be a primitive, right? And so by taking linear combinations of projections on each primitive, we can form new motion. But the problem is that if you actually want to combine these primitives together, just taking each axis individually, if you want to create a controller, a behavior for each axis, but you're creating that behavior for sort of like the marginal of this joint distribution. So if you create a controller for each marginal, that doesn't necessarily mean that their combination is going to produce something meaningful, right? Because they're not statistically independent, they're just orthogonal. Right? They're statistically independent to the second order. So this produced we could actually produce motion through this approach, but we couldn't break it up into separate individual controllers. So our second attempt was to use ISOMAP. And so for those of you not familiar with ISOMAP, it's essentially taking your data. So let's say we have 3D data that forms a Swiss roll, and finding a graph of nearest neighbors and using those nearest neighbors to perform shortest path distance. So once we have shortest path distance, we can try to take those distances and produce coordinates that preserve those distances. And since we're using shortest path distance, we're not taking Euclidean distance. So if I'm using Euclidean distance, points in this red area would be very close to the blue area in our resulting subspace embedding. But since we're using geodesic distance, shortest path distance, the distance metric actually goes around this Swiss roll curve. And then when I try to preserve those distances in embedding, that flattens the Swiss roll out into a nice 2D embedding. So this allows us to do nonlinear dimension reduction, geodesic multidimensional scaling. The problem is that when we actually look at these embeddings, we get erratic looking data. And the problem is that most data is inherently a time series. So how do we actually account for those temporal dependencies? And the way I think about this is, I actually want to take motion capture data and register it against itself, right? And when I mean register it against itself, I want to find at certain intervals, there's going to be motions are going to look very similar. They're going to have a sort of similar spatiotemporal process that I could correspond and say, you know, these things really look the same. Maybe I should put them together. I should reduce their distances and make them closer in the resulting embedding. And you know, even frames that look spatially similar, if I look at them over some history, they might actually be really different. So if we add history, and then we reduce distances between things that look similar, what we'll be able to do is register certain areas of the time series against itself and produce a nice looking effect. So to give a sort of example of this, consider I take a mouse and I put it at this start location. And I make a bunch of crescents. And I make crescents of different arc lengths, and they go up and down. And then halfway through, I move over to this other crescent, and I start going up and down, and I have different arcs. So this is a 2D trajectory laid out. If I run principal component analysis, I'll get the same data back with some, you know, probably transformed by some affine rotation. If I apply isomap, what it's going to do is take this data and essentially flatten it out. Right, it's gonna lay it out in a way that tries to preserve as much variance as possible while minimizing the dimensionality. But that's not really what's happening in my data. I'm actually going up and down, and I'm forming these sort of loop structures. If you look at what's going on, and so if I just add a little bit of history, if I just window my data, and I use principal component analysis, I'll get something that looks like this. I get for each crescent, I'll get a big loop. But the loop is going to be sort of have its own variance because I did different arc lengths. By trying to register these time series together, what I'm going to do is by reducing the distance between these spatiotemporal correspondences, what's going to happen is I'm going to reduce this variance more and more and more until I get the sort of two loop structure that's sort of very compact. Can everybody see this? It's maybe a little faint. But what I get is two loops that represent the movement along each curve. And at every point, it's sort of represented as the variance in the arc length. So if I sampled a bunch of points here, what I would get is some volume around that part of the arc that represents sort of the same location in the spatiotemporal process. Is that clear? If it's not, please stop me. So the essential process for doing this is I take my data, I have some sort of windowed Euclidean distance, and I use k nearest non-trivial neighbors. It's the same thing as k nearest neighbors, except if there are nearby frames, you want to consider those trivial matches to the current frame. So you don't want to consider two neighbors to be close in time. You want them to be sort of far apart. And then we compute shortest path distance and multidimensional scaling, which again takes distances and produces coordinates. And that is what allows us to get these embeddings. So what I get in the end is a set of movement primitives. So what we had in our data was some punching data. So we had punching that went like this, and we had moving our arm up and down, and so we had different dynamic systems for doing that, some for doing the twist and moving our arm back and forth and doing this dance that you always see the football players doing, and moving your arms up. And so this gives us a set of predictive models of human motion, a vocabulary of predictive models. And if I have video, because I made these videos actually in 2000, and QuickTime just doesn't seem to like them, despite my best efforts last night. What you would see is the motion. So this motion of a little stick figure doing this, when we apply it to these primitives, we have these primitives and we've applied them onto the robot. We can have the robot just, we can only control one arm at a time for the simulation, but we would have it do a very similar sort of twirling motion. We could have our, just a stick figure, because we assume that we have full observability on state. We could have it do a punch motion, and then basically that would, and we run it through our primitives through a match routine, we would be able to produce punching motion for a dynamically simulated humanoid. So that was the basis of my dissertation work, and I think when you're a graduate student, you're focused in and you're thinking about the problem that's in front of you, and my committee definitely said that I was looking at the trees instead of the forest. So when I graduated, I took a step back and I said, all right, what did I really do here? And what I was able to do is I was able to, towards the positive, I was able to find primitives or action, let's say action spaces in general, directly from raw motion capture data. I think that's a pretty big win. And there were similar papers that I've seen that appeared in robotics and vision and graphics that sort of do very similar things. So I think that was really good to get those in general, I thought. But towards the negative, I'm only considering free space motion. So I'm not having interactions with objects. I'm not doing anything interesting with the world. And so this led to us to think about new directions in manipulation, but also to say maybe we don't want to do imitation. Maybe we just want these motion models to do vision-based tasks, action recognition. And then there's also the notion of I have the model that I'm using is taking just regular human motion and trying to apply those to the robot. And one problem that we had with why we developed the inertial-based motion capture suit is that we just don't have enough human motion capture data. That may have changed now. We have much more motion capture data, but at the time we were still data starved, and we may still be data starved. So, and then also maybe it's not the best idea to try to have the take the robot, take human motion and try to put it into the robot space. Maybe the human should be thinking from the robot space, the teleoperation point of view. And then we learn from that, because maybe that's a way to collect more data. And this led us to think about mixed initiative lifelong learning, or learning from demonstration. So I'm going to talk about these projects. The first thing I'm going to talk about is mobile action recognition for human-robot teaming. And so I think when you think about human-robot interaction, what I found is there are a big diversity of opinions, and I'm going to take a particular view. So if you have a view of human-robot interaction and it's different than mine, humor me for right now. I'm going to plug my ICRA workshop, that sort of is a more that Manuela has graciously agreed to speak at. That sort of is a more discussion forum for thinking about different ways of how we can have some sort of more consensus on what HRI is. But for now, I'm going to consider human-robot interaction as collaboration. So that's two or more interacting autonomous embodiments, or a more supervised control for teleoperation or neural prosthetics, where you have a human decision maker who may be using their own perception and controlling some robot embodiment. So the human-robot team for the mobile action recognition case has, you have a robot with their own feedback control loop and a human running theirs. And what we're going to do is we're going to say we have motion primitives that we're going to use in perception as a prior for probabilistic tracking. And we're going to assume that those motion primitives are representative of the motion control of what the human is going to do, or how the human moves. and so the idea of this is that we want to enable mobile collaboration. So follow a person, robot should follow a person, stay in proximity, and perform tasks that are requested by a user. The user should try to make this as natural as possible. The human user should retain their own situational awareness and have as few interruptions as possible. So interruptions due to turning around and saying, robot, where are you? Looking to find the robot, or handling faults, or the robot bumping into them, or anything like that. So this video sort of shows some of this work. Let's tell you. And so she starts by giving the robot a gesture command. And the reason we can't use speech at a close distance is because the pack bot is just too loud, right? So in near interactions, it's really gesture that you want to use. But when the person gets further away, then speech might be better because then you're not in the view of the human. and so what made this, I think this is really good person following, but what made it possible is that we're using a depth camera. So we're using the Swiss Ranger SR3000. And that's it right there. And the depth camera, as I'll describe in a little bit, lets us use very simple methods for tracking and gesture recognition and person recognition. So the robot just went through the door, and so we're just considered as far away, and give a speech command saying, okay, you've done your thing, come back. Then when it comes back, excuse me, gets the command, we go. And because the depth camera uses a structured light approach, it's very easy to, you're not dependent upon the background, you're not sort of saddled with the same problems that you have in regular computer vision. So we can do this following indoors and outdoors, although it doesn't work on sunny days. So because it's a structured light solution, you could saturate the camera with sunlight. So we had to do this on a cloudy day. But actually, this is my favorite part, when you start walking it backwards. That's kind of cool. So that's that. So the origin of this project were that I said I had these great motion primitives and I want to use them and apply them. And so the first thing we did is we took a color camera and put it on top of a Roomba. Actually, that's not the setup we used. It actually is a little bit higher off the ground. But that picture looks actually worse than this camera taped on a Roomba. So we're actually able to do assuming that we can extract silhouettes, we're able to do reasonable gesture recognition. So here are the primitive models that are doing predictions, and we incorporate that into essentially a particle filter. And what we're doing is trying to make this as fast as possible. So so instead of having like a dense collection of particles, we have 36, and that lets us work at about 12 hertz, interactive time. And the reason we can use so few particles is because we're expecting the motion dynamics to accord to the predictions of these models, right? And so we get reasonable gesture recognition. When there's occlusions, there are problems, but something that I thought was usable. So we could give basic commands to the Roomba, except as soon as you give a command, the Roomba jumps when it moves. So you go out of view and then you lose tracking and then you come back and it's got to refind you. So that worked okay, but we thought it was good enough that we could take it to iRobot, we got this SBIR with, and apply it to their system. But we were wrong. We had good pose tracking and action recognition at Brown, but then we took the system to iRobot, and because it couldn't render, because whenever you have a pose hypothesis, you have to render this cylindrical model to the image buffer and do a comparison against the silhouette. Because they have an extremely slow graphics card, that grinded this process to a halt, one frame a second, basically. And so we had to say, okay, maybe this whole probabilistic particle filter business just isn't going to work. So my student that was working on this project, he went back to the basics and he said, okay, what do I need to do to just get a hidden Markov model to work? And the hidden Markov model worked great. And I don't think it's anything, I mean, we used a stock hidden Markov model. I mean, we did nothing special. But I believe that the reason it worked was because we used the depth camera. Because we used this system that actually, that actually provided relatively clean silhouettes. Let me put that, So this is the intensity image, but you actually get a depth image, and from that depth image, it's relatively easy to separate, to separate people from the background. Except, when you partition them, you don't form a connected component of the top and the bottom split. But when you have really good silhouettes, the basic things work. And I bet that if you use temporal templates or other simple methods from vision, they'll probably work as well. But when you use a hidden Markov model, you're not as general. You know, so we don't have the general, you know, we can't recognize different forms of the action. We're recognizing more specific motions. So here's just more videos on that topic. So here's Nate, and he's walking around with the color footage, and you can see the segmented image that we get. I mean, that looks great, right? Simple things with a better camera is essentially what worked. And then we also, this was from our early person following, and we found that the person detection was so good that we could, you know, that you didn't even have to have like a collision detection routine. As long as the person walked in roughly a reasonable space, the robot would avoid obstacles, more or less. So going the hidden Markov model approach sort of took us in the direction of saying, let's model dynamics, motion dynamics, as cheaply as possible. But if you want to go the other way, and you know, there's really hard vision problems, what if you actually want to use the dynamics as, what if you want more realistic dynamics? What if you actually, when you're tracking somebody, they have violent interactions with balls and hopefully not crates, but you know, they definitely have ground floor interactions. So what if we use, you know, so more of the vision style work that I'm doing is, what if we use dynamical simulation with tracking? And this is early work. If you're reviewing our paper for CVPR, your review should be in, so this shouldn't be a problem, hopefully. And so we use this with multi-view input and monocular input. And so what we're really getting with walking is better interaction with the ground, right? So we should get one better tracking, but we should also get tracking that's more, I wouldn't say robust, but more appropriate for when you're having interactions with something physical, like the ground or wall or something hitting you. And we've gotten some better results than just using straight particle filtering. All right, so that's some work that we've done with mobile human robot teaming. I'm going to switch gears on you and talk about using regression for mixed initiative lifelong learning. So in this case, the human robot team, you have a human who has some intended decision-making policy in their mind, and they want to apply that to the robot. They want that to become the robot's decision-making policy. And to do that, we're going to use learning from demonstration. In particular, we're looking at Gaussian process regression. And more or less, this sort of lets me think about developmental robotics. And developmental robotics is sort of, it conjures notions to me about what is innate, what's the things that we want hard-coded into the robot, and what's adaptive, what are the things that need to learn. So in this case, we're going to assume that we have structured, we have hard-coded perceptual features, in this case, color blob tracking, and we have a structured set of actions for motion control, and we want to learn decision-making, specifically decision-making for robot soccer. So when we started this project, we made a guess that maybe we have the right algorithms already, but we just don't have enough data. So if we had enough data, we could learn a viable policy with existing algorithms. So we tried a nearest neighbor regressor, and we tried that for the US Open in 2000, and that did not work very well. you could laugh if you want to, it wasn't very good. And part of that was because we didn't have enough data. Because we went down to Atlanta and the lighting changed, and so we couldn't do data collection fast enough. And so we've been thinking about video game style interfaces to collect data. And we also want the robot to be able to take this data, learn policies incrementally online, and then whenever they're uncertain, to be able to say, I need some more data, could you please help me out? But all this is going towards, let's collect lots and lots and lots of data and see if we can do supervised learning. So we took this mixed initiative approach where we have a structured platform which has sensors and actuators and structured motion control and perception. And we use the mixed initiative approach where we're going to have a learning mechanism which is going to do regression, and which is arbitrated against sort of a default innate policy that's sort of its default behavior, and whatever a teacher would do via a game style interface. Right. Videos. All right, so I will pop out and show this video real quick. Because it doesn't want to work. So this is our student Dan Goldman, who is working on this project. Hopefully this video is self-explanatory. So in this case, he's trying to get the robot to find a goal and charge. And so he first shows the robot by teleoperating with the gamepad, and it charges the goal. And he's just using standard color blob tracking in order to find this goal. So it's just, I mean, this is a cute trick to have the robot move around and find the goal. Hopefully he'll have a ball kicking around soon in this video.
So how did it know, for instance, that the task wasn't to center itself between the two vision modes? Which was just as reasonable from the demonstration.
I think he stops before, so it's based on the size of the blob in the field of view, right? So I think when the blob gets to be a certain size, he just stops. And so when you look at the function at that point, it also just stops. And so there's no data passed there, so the robot just stops and is probably asking for more data more than anything else. So that's him kicking the ball around. So if you look at coded controllers, so a coded controller for just sort of tracking the ball, it follows this nice sort of, so here's the ball position horizontally in the view, and you have this nice sort of vertical line, and you know, that gives you a nice rule for how you should move the head to put the ball in the center of your field of view. But that's the coded controller. If you look at human demonstration, you've got points all over the place. It's a mess, right? And so how do we actually deal with this type of data? So the first thing we did was use k-nearest neighbors, and that didn't work out so well because there's discontinuities, and k-nearest neighbors doesn't handle those discontinuities well. So the next thing we used was locally weighted projection regression, and that worked well, except for when we needed to start to manipulate a ball. And so I'm just going to assume that everybody knows what this is, that Chris has trained you well, and you know what that is. So we looked at Gaussian process regression. We said, you know, the issue with locally projection regression is that we had everything had to be normalization, at least in say two of Vijay Kumar's code. But also, how do you place the receptive fields in the right order so that you can actually get a good approximation? And so selecting the receptive fields proved to be pretty difficult. So we said, let's try to keep all of our data around, and Gaussian process regression, I'm going to roughly characterize it as probabilistic kernelized k-nearest neighbors. And that provides a good way for doing that, but then you have to keep all the data around. So then we looked at Sato and Opper's sparse online Gaussian processes, and that has proved to work out very well for us, and I'll show videos in a second. More towards the machine learning, hardcore machine learning approach, my student Dan has looked into things based off of infinite mixtures of experts. So there's infinite mixtures of Gaussian process experts, and we've just did a little bit of work in terms of trying to do incremental mixing of Gaussian process experts, but that's sort of future work. But we are moving towards maybe sparse incremental mixtures of online Gaussian process experts. So what worked for us is the sort of head mirroring task, where you pull the tail and the tail is going to move the tail around and that controls the head, right? And we can learn a mapping from these proprioceptive mappings that sort of learn one mapping from a part of the body to another mapping. And so, you know, local weird projection regression, Gaussian processes, both work pretty well. But we ran into a problematic issue when we tried to actually manipulate a ball. Because what happens, so here's a teaching policy, it comes in and tries to acquire a ball. And the issue is that dealing with this sort of, there's like this quick transition in state where the ball comes into view and comes out of view, and do you have it, have you acquired it or not? And this causes a, and it's sort of a binary variable, and that causes normalization issues for locally weighted projection regression. But the, but if we keep enough data around with like sparse online Gaussian processes, we can build models that actually learn how to acquire this ball. So we're sort of starting from building all the different pieces together to hopefully, by the time he proposes, build an attack.
No red curve.
One thing that we're also deploying in-house is a sort of Wii-based gaming interface. So these guys are using a keyboard and mouse, but they can see what the robot sees, and we're going to have, you know, hopefully have like 8-on-8 games of people downstairs in our undergraduate lab playing against each other. And so this is just a simple sort of first-person interface that we've come up with.
So,
yeah.
You have no heat in your undergraduate lab.
We have no what?
Heat.
They need to generate the heat by themselves by working really hard. Or it could be that looking like you're cold is the cool thing to do these days. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. So in the, what did you say I have? 10 minutes? 5 minutes?
About 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Sorry. The next 10 minutes, I'm going to go real fast through some more manipulation-related efforts that we're doing. So in the case of a human robot team, if you have some sort of prosthetic device, what you have is a human that you have some sort of embodiment that is the basic actuation interface. But humans provide the sensing and perception and do decision making, which then produces some sort of, you know, probably a some sort of command signal that you would give to the motion control routines of the servos or the actuators. However, if you're doing neural prosthetics, such as controlling a cursor from a cyberkinetics device, what you have is what you get from the output of the human decision making is really the sort of coarse, maybe 2 to 3 dimensional signal. And that, you know, that I think the upper limits of the bandwidth, at least when I checked a year or so ago, was about 10 bits per second. But if you want to do motion control, you have more variables with a higher sampling rate than that. So how do you actually deal with the sort of sparse control problem between the low dimensional signal you get from the human user to the high dimensional signal you need to provide to the robot? So I'll just show a quick neural decoding video. This is from a Nature paper by John Donahue's group at Brown. So they have an implant in the brain here, and they're controlling a 2-dimensional cursor just from neural activity. So move cursor around, brain fire. But you don't really get 10 bits. They've also done, they took a Lynx motion arm and controlled that too, just by moving to different points in space, or different points in the two-dimensional signal. I mean, the two-dimensional screen. So what we do is we have, you know, like I said, 2-dimensional user input, but 13, so if you control the DLR hand, which we have, you have a 13 degree of freedom robot degrees of freedom. But you know, most of what you see is power grasping. But what if you want to do things like precision grasp or tapping or something else? And so what we try to do is break up this problem into a sort of a preliminary step to sort of have a 2D interface that humans can click on points into a subspace of robot poses, and then be able and see if that could potentially be a cursor-driven system. To skip all this. And so in order to generate a subspace, a 2-dimensional subspace that can produce hand poses from 2-dimensional input, we took a bunch of hand motion capture data, and we used dimension reduction. In particular, well, we surveyed a bunch of different dimension reduction techniques in order to produce a 2-dimensional embedding. And then when somebody would click on a point in this space, we would have out-of-sample methods to project back into a 13-dimensional pose space. So these are some of the methods that we looked at. That at the time we considered were state of the art. And motion capture data looked like this. That's too slow, so I'm gonna skip that. But what you wanna avoid is similar graphs being projected on the same space. You wanna remove that ambiguity as much as possible. You like to have a nice clean separation between finger tapping and power grasping and different types of precision grasps. And so this is some of the motions that we were looking at. So tapping motion, This is the DLR hand that we got a really good deal on from Schunk. So that's a power grasp. There's also a precision grasp, but I'm going to move on. You'll see all these again. So by clicking on points in this interface, we could interactively have the robot do things like grasp a bottle. Or grasp a small eraser, so with a precision grasp. Skip all those. And so we also wanted to see if we could, if we had a moving object, if we could grasp that through various precision grasps and power grasps. And we were able to do this relatively, it takes a little bit of practice, but, able-bodied people can control this hand reasonably well from this interface. We also created a little dining scenario, too, where since we don't have a robot arm, we had the student come in, and they're the robot arm. Because you want to enable people to do the basic things in their daily life. So you have to use something more like a power grasp on the eating utensil, but a precision grasp on the bottle. Yeah, I'm sure there's some intelligence going on with the student holding the face. But. So I think you guys get the. And we also tried, since the Wiimote, controlling a mouse by Wiimote is a little bit more difficult, we tried just using that as sort of something to emulate roughly the noise that you would get from neural decoding. So we did that too. So the last thing I'm going to talk about in the 4 minutes that I have remaining is uncovering success in signatures from manipulation. So in this case, you have a teleoperator. They want to pick up objects and use tools, build stuff, or fix stuff. So but the robot has really a lack of tactile sense, right? I mean, so if you look at the human hand, we have nerves all over the place. In fact, you can make a case. I think somebody told me that we know when we picked up an object or we're going to have a successful grasp because of the shearing effect of the skin, because the skin is pulling down because gravity is pulling off. But the robot on hand didn't have nearly as many sensors. They had good force sensors, but only maybe 20 or so. So how do you deal with sort of this disparity? And even when you have these, you tend to make mistakes. I personally make a lot of mistakes when I'm teleoperating the robot because I don't have that tactile sensation. And plus, you spend a lot of time making mistakes and recovering from those mistakes rather than being productive. And putting all these head-mounted displays in a teleoperated robot takes a lot out of me. 90 minutes is the best that I can do. But I think 45 minutes is more of like the time that the cognitive, the amount of time you can sort of sit through that cognitive load. So we wanted to find success in manipulation. So we wanted to find four signatures that represented successful, that could discriminate successful versus unsuccessful manipulation. So we did different tasks. So if you look at it just grasping an object, like grasping a wrench, there's a definite clustering that forms. So this is when you have no contact, and then when you actually close on an object, you get sort of a clustering over here, and you can sort of see the transitions back and forth. But it's rough, and it's hard to see in PCA. When we use spatial temporal isomap, we get a very nice sort of signature, signature of what it feels like to grasp an object. So you have a cluster that means you're not in contact, but you're reaching, and then when you close, you have a loop that takes you to another cluster, and then when you release from a hold, you go back to the other cluster. And when you do this, you can take new grasps, sensory signals from new grasps, and then project into this new space. And so it sort of defines what it feels like to grasp an object. And we also did this for socketing, for mating a drill with a lug nut. And we had trials of successful versus unsuccessful. So blue is the successful and red was the unsuccessful trials. When we embedded spatial temporal isomap, we see that they separate. And when we project new trials into there, so highlighted in bold are these are the new trials, they sort of follow a similar pattern of successful versus unsuccessful. And then so we also did this with a chisel grasping. And so we get an embedding that, that sort of looks like this, where successful versus unsuccessful really start to separate. And you can see sort of like this is a pre-grasp and no release state where you have no contact. And then when you actually make a closure, a successful closure, that you know that the sensory signals sort of go to this side of the low dimensional embedding. And when there's a failure, they sort of go to this side. And so this is sort of a video of us taking the signature and sort of looking and seeing whether you have success or fail conditions for each manipulation. This was done in batch, so we weren't classifying in real time, but this is just to illustrate successful manipulation or not. So thank you, that says. Blah, 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 blah. If you want to hear about distributed action selection, you'll have to see me offline. And conclusion, critical issue for robotics, robot programming, manipulation, communication, usability. I think learning is one great approach to doing this. Thank you.
Learning by imitation, maybe also for the difficult skills like the robot soccer and all the manipulation. So, any questions? Yes.
I'll give you a hard one. So, I know you consistently use the term human robot teams.
Right.
But early on, you advocated that robotics needs to manage.
Right.
And by some definition, that's more of a tool as opposed to a collaborator.
Right. Yeah. If you pin me down on the semantics, you're right. It's a tool. But I think because robots are in the real world, they are a means to an end to some extent. So they are a tool. But because they're in the real world, they serve a collaborative purpose. You want to work together to do something. So yeah, if you split hairs on me, I get lost in the semantics, but I think but you're right. But collaborators sound better.
So I can ask a question. So sure. What do you think is the next challenging problem to address within these learning from data? So you mentioned right. You had a lot of data, right?
Right.
So is it like that the data should be, is it the breadth of the task? Is it the temporal aspect of the data? So is it success and failure?
I think it's finding relevant tasks.
I see.
That we can, and having persistent, have robots that are on persistently. Because I think you could make the case that we have the algorithm in place, or we don't necessarily know enough about how to fix these algorithms so that they're suitable for doing this purpose. So we can do, I think there's lots of things that we can do, sort of one-off tasks that, that work really well and are suited for that purpose. But how do we actually have persistent interaction so we can learn these things? And I'm not the only one advocating this, So Cynthia Brazil and the work that she's done in socially guided machine learning has definitely guided some of my thoughts on this. So and there are many others, so.
Yes, please.
Oh, I'm gonna get it now.
So I spent a lot of time wondering what's wrong
right.
with learning from demonstration as right. currently practiced by myself and others.
Right, right.
And I've decided basically we operate as if everything is meaningless. There's essentially no prior knowledge, and it's all just statistics, little dots on
right.
little plots. And I think that's a very limiting paradigm. And what I stand up when I teach classes and this kind of stuff is I say, look, if we look at how humans work, they watch the dog
right.
catch the ball with its head. And if you ask them, why did the dog drop its head on the ball, they give you a coherent, meaningful, concise answer.
Right.
They're, to me, I wake up every morning and I get out of bed because I believe we have high level knowledge
yeah.
right.
that dramatically speeds everything up. Yet as a field, as far as I can tell, we totally failed to make any progress
right.
towards that goal.
Right.
You're the future.
Oh, that's the jinx right there. I'm gonna get it back.
You are the future, and you are missing that bullet.
Yeah. How are you going to get us high-level knowledge?
Yeah. Right.
But
I would claim that that high-level knowledge took years to get, a lot of trial and error.
I totally disagree.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
My favorite example is pinball. I take somebody in, I say, watch me play pinball. Bing, bang, bap, 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 you know, confusion, chaos. And then suddenly the ball comes near one of the paddles, and I hold the button in, the paddle goes up, and I catch the ball.
Right.
Instantly. They don't have to have ever seen a pinball thing before.
Right.
And instantly they'll say, yeah, I know what you're doing. You're catching the ball with the paddle.
But they've got some notion of how, you know, how a button works, or how they move their finger to press a button.
But I do not believe that it's built out of layer after layer of statistics.
Oh no, I agree with that. There's something hard coded, that's innate in the human, you know, body, human embodiment that allows us to do these things, right? I mean, that's the reason why, you know, I can grasp things. I can do pull-ups, right? It's easy for me to do. Well, I shouldn't say it used to be easy for me to do pull-ups. But there are other sorts of tasks that are more difficult because I have to move my arm in different ways. And so my embodiment sort of shapes the, you know, how I can do a task. And I have a knowledge of how my body works. I have, you know, self-awareness. And so that, I think that's a big, you know, I know what my body can do innately. So that's a big prior that I have that could guide the system. But the issue that I have is that if I ask a biologist or a neuroscientist, you know, what are these priors? They're, you know, I get a variety of answers, but I want to be flexible enough that when they do have a good, they could pass the prior for me, that I could put that into my system, and then maybe all the dots will work. I do need to have some notion of intentionality. I don't do any intentionality recognition. I think that's another hard problem that hopefully somebody else will help me with. So you're right. I don't have a sense of how to do that just yet. Even when you're trying to assemble things together, you know, you have to have a notion of you put this together and that together. And when you're building structures, that's another problem that you need high level knowledge for. So if anybody wants to come to Brown to work on that, I'm all game for that too. So you're right.
Well,
I don't want to take any more of your Friday time off.
So should we thank him again?